can't rain all the time, and Fright Rags is celebrating the 25th anniversary of The Crow with three brand new shirts. Also celebrate your love for Fangoria with the reprinted 1979 Stress Tee, along with brand new tees featuring the classic Starlog and my favorite, the Gore Zone logo. All officially licensed and available exclusively at FrightRags.com. Listeners get 10% off for their first order with code WAVES10. Beware, these scary stories will transform you. The Creeping Hour is a horror anthology series hosted by The Creeps, three friends who listen to so many scary stories that they turned into monsters themselves. Gather your whole family to shiver with fright as you listen to the terrifying tales of The Creeping Hour. Listen if you dare. Don't say we didn't warn you. The Creeping Hour is a co-production of WGBH and Ellie Lichtenstein. It is appropriate for all ages and recommended for ages 8 to 12. It's at thecreepinghour.org.
Some of you may know us as Shockwaves, or two-fourths of Shockwaves. We know Rick right here. Hello. Thank you for waiting and being patient. We were dealing with Hurricane Elvira out there, which is fine.
Ryan's Halloweening. Ryan's making a Halloween sequel for you guys.
Our co-host Ryan Turk is doing the new Halloween.
Yeah, Rebecca was coming to the last minute, but she had to go to a set. We can't say where, but she's on a set. She's learning valuable things so she can make good movies in the future. So that's very good. But we wanted to make sure, we wanted an interesting balance for this episode. So we actually threw to the festival asking who might be good to get a different perspective. So it wasn't just, as they say, a sausage party up here on Tales from the Crypt, which is often a sausage party, the show. And so we wanted to get these guys who are very, we have Jessica, who is coming from the festival perspective. And we have Theo, who also has a podcast that they did announce, but you might not have heard it. It's called Freaky Franchise, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and also we have, interesting age ranges. So, we were just making fun of her before.
Are you calling me old?
She wasn't really alive when this came out. So it's that's a different perspective. So,
I think I might have seen some as an infant. And that, influenced who I am as a person today.
I think she was conceived during an episode. That's the story we're going to go for, right, Mom? Thank you. It was definitely... I know which episode it probably was. we're excited. This is exciting. It's always cool to get to meet you guys in person. Please don't feel at all intimidated. Come up to us. Say hi. We've been wanting to have John on from the very beginning, and we've talked about it, and it's amazing that it's worked out live, so it's cool.
Well, yeah. I've always been a big fan of the show, as everybody in the room is, and I go back to the FearNet days when we had Tales from the Crypt on FearNet and did a lot of work with John there. So it's great to have you on our show in front of all these people.
Thanks, creeps.
we tend to mix up our format when we do the show live. And so a little bit further down the line, you're going to see clips from all of our favorite episodes. We all picked five each. There might be some crossover. There might not. But we want to start just by talking to John and getting to know him a little bit, because we don't really know exactly how you became a part of this show. If you can give us some context, were you doing stand-up comedy at the time?
I was a theater actor, actually. I've done everything from, I started out getting paid $175 a week working off Broadway in New York right out of college. And you know how that works out. I made more money street performing than I ever made in the theater. I got in a play called Three Guys Naked from the Waist Down. And wasn't actually naked. Starred myself with Scott Bakula, who you all know. Yeah, and a guy named Jerry Kolker, who wrote the piece. Think Dreamgirls, but with stand-up comics. So it was a musical. It was three stand-up comics, and we also played all the agents and the reporters. Three comics that couldn't barely wipe their own ass. But, wound up, the three of them together wound up being the next Three Stooges. And I played a guy who was, kind of this suicidal Andy Kaufman-ish type, really dark kind of stand-up. And it was a breakout character for me. And I got asked to come on to the first season of Star Search, As a stand-up comic. And I said, well, you know, I'm not really a stand-up comic. And they go, well, you can win $100,000. I'm like, fuck, have you seen my act? And so, and I went on the show and I won.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, and I had done sketch comedy and street performing and that kind of thing. So I was writing these sketches. You know, I would do like The Wizard of Oz in 2.5 minutes. As mayor of the Munchkin City. You know, and I would do all this stuff every week. And I kept winning, so I kept having to come up with characters. And so really my break into Hollywood was as a stand-up comic winning Star Search, beat Rosie O'Donnell in the semifinals and Sinbad in the finals, who I saw in the airport last night, by the way.
Full circle.
Yeah, totally. I saw Sinbad carrying his guitar going, oh, I got one more gig I gotta fucking do before I'm done with my road trip. And I was like, it's good to see you. I hadn't seen him in a long time. Really sweet guy, by the way. So everybody knew me as this guy that did all these voices and characters because I had no act. So I had to do, like, you know, I started, my whole act was based on a guy who could change channels on himself and was addicted to television. And so that was my act. So people knew I did that. And I got my first series on HBO called First and Ten. And I know that a bunch of you guys watched that when you were kids because it was the first show with tits on it. and that launched my television career, but HBO called me up and said, you know, we want you to come audition for Tales from the Crypt. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me, I love those comic books as a kid, they're turning that into a series. They're like, yeah, we're gonna make it into a series and we want you to come audition for it. Go down to Kevin Yeager's studio. I go, wait a minute, Kevin Yeager, the guy who made Chucky and designed Freddy Krueger? And you go, yeah, we go down to his studio. I go, I get to go down to Kevin Yeager's studio? They go, yeah, and audition for him. And I go down there and they have a bunch of other actors and they're all looking at the scripts going, be careful what you ask for. You may get it. What is, you know, and I'm like going, they don't get it. This guy loves us. This Shakespeare to this guy. You know, it's like Alfred Hitchcock thought, you know, puns were like the best of alliteration. And I plugged that into it. And when I saw the puppet that he was working on, and by the way, a lot of people know nowadays, but they didn't used to know that, you know, they didn't give Kevin much money to work with. You know, HBO didn't have a lot of money back then. They had just started out. And they didn't give you a lot of money to start with. Kevin had to make a puppet out of spare parts in his studio. Mm. And he took and used Chucky's eyes in The Crypt Keeper, which is why he has these beautiful baby blues. He had different versions of them, but this was something similar to this was what he was working with at that point. And he had just a boom box with a little microphone. And he goes, hey, can you record into this? And so I'm like, you know, hello, creeps. And he's like, and I start laughing, he starts laughing, and I'm laughing at my own jokes and laughing at the puns. I'm like, good part of the character. He laughs at his own shit. This is great. And I started doing it for him, and the next day he had me doing it for Joel Silver and Dick Donner in some trailer that they had on the set, you know, for them to have as an office. And these were two of the biggest movie-making
Superman and Back to the Future.
Totally.
As big as it gets.
Oh my God, forget it. And Die Hard, all those movies. Yeah. I mean, and here I was in their office doing the Crypt Keeper for them, you know, and that probably added a little shaking to his voice, which I kept. And they were like, okay, we'll see you on the set. And that was it. It was maybe one of the easiest jobs I ever got. And the most known character that I've ever done and the longest lasting. And some of you people were sneaking down when you weren't supposed to, and you, or either that or your parents were cool and they let you watch it. I hear that all the time. It's like, well, my parents wouldn't let me watch it, but grandma and I watched it every weekend. It was really cool, man. So, you know, and that's how it came to be. And here 30 years later, you know, the Crypt Keeper is all part of your nightmare.
Did they let you see the episodes before you were to record your parts, or did you just, were they totally separate?
I would read them because they may have been in the middle of recording them, shooting them, because literally we had to shoot this show on a budget that was much less than you would imagine for a network show. And yet,
even at the start, even, the first episodes, first season looks so big.
Production. Yeah, well, you know, here's what happened. You know, HBO, like you may notice that there's a lot of the earlier shows on HBO, and we were talking about this earlier, a lot of the earlier shows on HBO are not on HBO Go and that kind of thing, because they don't own them. Because they would say, we'll make the show with you, and we'll give you money to make the first season, but then each season you have to put more of your own money into it or get money from other people where it's going to be shown on their network later or, you know, for ancillary rights or whatever. And but you get to own it that way, and because that's the only way you can do it, sell it, resell it, is if you own it. And so they had to put a lot of their own money in it. And so they got favors, and because they were big guys, they could get all the actors to work for scale. They could get all the directors to work for whatever was the scale for directors, and they got the best directors in the business. Yeah. And then there were actors who wanted to direct. They got to come play.
And writers who got to direct for the first time. Talent fiesta. Yeah, it's crazy.
The Oil's Well That Ends Well, which is the episode that I was on camera in, was directed by Paul Abascal, who was known to be an effects makeup guy who worked for Joel Silver for many years and had never directed anything. Always had wanted to, and so Joel said, here you go, here's an episode. And Michael J. Fox came on and directed an episode, and Arnold Schwarzenegger came and directed an episode, and Michael Keaton and Tom Hanks and all these people who wanted to have their hand at directing got to do it. And they had two camera crews that one would be prepping for the next episode while the other one was shooting, and so they didn't have a lot of time to show me much of anything. So they just kind of like cut me loose, which was a lot of fun.
Would you do like a whole season at once in terms of all the voices?
No, I do one or two episodes at a time. And Kevin Yeager and I would go into the studio and do most of them because he was going to direct the sequences.
Did your voice come first before they would film the Crypt Keeper?
Yeah, they'd have to, because it was like it took three puppeteers just to make the face move.
Oh, wow.
You know, they had like there was one guy had like a head case on when he would move it up and down and move the jaw, and then he had these toggle switches for the lips, so he'd be like, hello creeps, how are you? So, and then another guy would move this part of the face, and then a guy would move the eyes and the tongue, and then was another guy was one hand in the head and the other guy was the other hand. And so it was, this is a kabuki style of puppetry, if you've ever seen them. The guy's wearing the black shrouds and they're all moving the puppet together, and you're really just watching the puppet, not the guys. You know, it's that style of puppetry. These guys were brilliant, you know. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the show is so hard to get back on the air. It was an expensive show to do. It took a lot of artisans to make this show. They were doing stuff like, okay, well, we have a set, and there's like a couple of chairs and things, but we need the walls, and we need hanging moss. And they would make a little miniature and put it in the foreground of the camera so that they were creating sets that weren't actually there. They were just kind of like, you know, in front of the camera like this.
Yeah.
They were using some of the most ingenious methods of movie making with no money. And it translated into bringing that comic book to life, which is really what we were trying to do. So I would go in it, and Kevin was brilliant directing these Crypt Keeper sequences. They're so much fun. Each one has something. And then I would just crack them up by doing, okay, you know, I would do the Crypt Keeper as, you know, Marlon Brando. Stella! You know, and the next week they'd write it in, you know. He'd be like his bony little arms with a torn T-shirt going, Stella! You know. And so that kind of evolved. If you go into some of the later episodes, you start to see the Crypt Keeper kind of becoming the performer that I had become.
You know? It's not improv. You're never improvising, but you're giving something that then got developed in later.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Like I remember just being funny and saying, you know, I love a girl who'll give you head and then let you keep it. And I was like, I'm thinking that'll never go well. Shit, man. Crypt Keeper sitting in bed with a girl with a box of chocolates. He puts his arm around her, head falls into his lap, and he goes, I love a girl who'll give you head and then let you keep it. You know, so.
I was going to ask you, but now I think you've answered. I was always curious, was there ever a pun that they wrote that you pushed back on? Was there ever anything that you were like, no, I have my limits, I have a line. But I'm guessing that you pushed that line.
Yeah, totally. Totally. My wife, who's here, was like, oh, you need to stop recycling the same ones. You got to go back and remember some of the really good ones, juicy ones, because, you know, people come up and they want to hear something, or, you know, now they have those Cameo apps, and people are like, can you do a birthday shout-out for me? You know, and you're like, I got to go into my mental Rolodex. It's been 30 years, you know, trying to come up with those puns. But it wasn't easy for the writers I mean, we had good writers, and you could tell how good they were because sometimes they would, you know, later on they would pimp out the Crypt Keeper for, you know, some hockey team or, you know, Bud Light, where they had good writers, but you'd get bad writers and the puns would just be bad, and you'd be like, oh, this is not working. You know, and I'd suggest yeah. something, and they're like, yeah, let's go with that, you know.
At what point did he, so I guess that's the key, at what point did the pop culture phenomenon of the Crypt Keeper, in the same way that Freddy, would you say Freddy's like after part three? Like it's after part, it's part four, he's like icon. So with this, what season was it? Was it within season one or was it after season one?
You know, people loved the Crypt, Tales from the Crypt for sure, and they were like, oh my gosh, but that was a really an exclusive audience. Mm. It was the people who were kids or young people that saw this show that later adopted it as part of their pop culture and made it their own. There's a larger audience for Tales from the Crypt now than there ever was when it was originally on the air, which is unusual because that's not true of everything, especially in horror. But I could tell because, you know, I mean, when I'd go see a friend at a convention and somebody would walk up to me and go, dude, can I have your autograph? And I'd be like, for what? Tales from the Crypt, man. What are you talking about? And I was like, really? Yeah, okay. You know, and when I first started doing conventions, it was like, you know, you'd get people that had seen the show and loved the show and that kind of thing. And then eventually all of a sudden it was like, oh man, I grew up with Tales from the Crypt. I had the doll, and I watched the cartoon. I watched the game show.
Christmas special.
The Christmas,
Christmas album.
The album. Christmas album.
Yeah.
Mo title bomb, Mo title bomb. You didn't bomb my dad and mom. Yeah. Great stuff. That was one of my favorite things we did, truly.
But at what point was that stuff? Because that's the thing you're doing. You're doing like a rap single and a video, and you're doing Deck the Halls with Parts of Charlie, personal favorite. So that must have been a point where, hey,
well,
this is...
That came with the part where they realized that, you know, that the Crypt Keeper had started to take on, you know, my stand-up qualities, my performance kind of entity of the character. And they realized that the Crypt, you know, I had gone to, we were talking about this earlier too, I had gone to a Fangoria convention, and, you know, it was 2,500 people in the audience that were similar to yourselves, and they're like, hey, man, when are you going to make the episode with the glass coffin and all this stuff? And on stage with me was Joel Silver and Bob Zemeckis and Richard Donner and Kevin Yeager and all these things. When they introduced me, people went nuts, and they were like, wow, Crypt Keeper's popular. He's like really good. And it made sense. I mean, if I was a kid and I was walking past, I don't care how scared I was, if I saw that puppet on TV and from the other room I heard, hello, kiddies.
Yeah.
Of course I'm going to watch it. I don't care if my parents told me I can't watch it or not. I'm going to watch it.
Well, and they made a cartoon.
Totally. Yeah.
A cartoon that character. That's a whole other fan base.
I begged them to make a kid's show, and they were like, okay, we'll make a cartoon. I was like, no, you need a live-action kid's show. They go, kids aren't going to. It's too scary. I was like, they just Goosebumps did it. You know, and, it was, and now probably I might have been wrong because the kids were watching this one. And they shouldn't have been, but they did.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all you guys. So it's great. And the popularity has grown and grown and grown to where he's a part of not only nostalgia but pop culture. And he's a Halloween icon. And I know people relate me to him in that way, and I'm glad they do, because you're lucky if, you know, in 40 years as an actor to have one thing that people, you know, I could tell you I did movies and television series and sitcoms that, you know, bought my house and all that stuff. I didn't get paid much for this at all, but this is the thing people will remember. I can tell you, you know, a show, and I turned down Full House, you know, which people are like, what, are you crazy? You'd be a millionaire. I go, yeah,
as a comedian,
I'd be out
comedian
of work.
Character? They cut it out?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
No, as the Joey.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, no, I'm so glad I turned that down. Because I'd be an out-of-work millionaire. But
you wouldn't be here with us.
Yeah, exactly.
You're
exactly.
With us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm glad that I got to do the kind of things that I wanted to do and that made me happy. And nothing makes me happy. I seriously used to have to hide these comic books from my mother because she... Oh, they cause juvenile delinquency, you know. And that's what they believe. The reason they have, age codes on the comic books, as a lot of you know, is because of the EC Comics. So there you go. That's how we came to be like this. And I'm not. It's. I'm sure there's a lot of people you meet and you like. You're a big fan of their work, and they're really appreciative, and they really love you as fans for loving what they do. And they may have hated the project that they worked on, for the fact that may not have got paid well for it. They may not have got along with the actors or the director or the producers, or you know, any number of reasons, or they just don't want to be remembered just for that. But for me, it couldn't have been more of something that I loved as a kid. I cut my teeth on Universal horror monster movies. Abbott Costello Meets Frankenstein is still my favorite, you know, horror/comedy movie. You know, so I feel really fortunate to do it. So I watched the episodes. I loved the episodes. I loved the show, and I'm really proud to be a part of such a great show.
Before we get into the actual episodes, did you notice behind the scenes big shifts? Season to season, were there any major? Obviously, the last season—that's a big shift because it went to the UK. But beyond that, just for us, I'm watching them, and I think there's quality episodes all the way through.
Oh yeah.
But was there any change in focus throughout?
Well, there was change. Obviously, there was change in the Crypt Keeper because of the first Crypt Keeper, because they didn't give Kevin much money. His mouth barely moves, so you're like.
He talks slower and more ominously.
To the point where some people don't even think it's me, you know, and we just had to because he couldn't. I come in and go, "Hello, Craven." Kevin be like, no. He has to talk slower, you know. And then, of course, once the show was popular, they gave him more money and he spruced it up and made him work better and we got to make him funnier and faster and this kind of thing. But the episodes... people were begging to get on the show after a while because it was, you know, and then of course we got to the seventh season, which was an afterthought. We were done after six seasons, and then it started to become popular in the UK, they wanted to get involved. And they're like, hey, come shoot it here, we'll put money into it. And of course, there's people in it, we didn't even know who they were. We didn't know who Ewan McGregor was. He was in an episode. We didn't know who Daniel Craig was. He's in an episode. We didn't know who Emma Sams was or any of these. We didn't know who they were. And they wound up in these episodes. I don't know if they got the humor exactly. I think they try to put a little more, more comedy into it than it actually asks for. Mm. They're just kind of funny as they are. But so it's not everybody's favorite season, but that one was definitely different than some of the other episodes. And every episode was different depending on who wrote it, who directed it, and who starred in it, because they could change the feeling of it completely. Just like Bordello of Blood is so different from Demon Knight.
Yeah.
You know, Demon Knight is maybe one of my favorite horror movies ever made, and Ernest Dickerson, who I've sat...
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah, you know, I've sat and listened to him talk about what he went through to try to get it cast the way he wanted it and shoot it in a movie hangar. I mean, in an airplane hangar, because he wanted that two-story set, and, you know, and those demons were so incredible, and Billy Zane was so incredible, and the soundtrack's got some of the best, you know, rock music I've ever heard in it, and and then Bordello of Blood is like an extended episode of Tales from the Crypt, the show. So they're both classic Tales from the Crypt. Hey, nobody walks out on me.
She likes Ritual the most. That's why she left. She just is like, you weren't talking about it, so
let's not even go there with that one. But you know, that one was classic too, and in a different way, in a more cartoony kind of fun way. So some of the episodes had, you know, so that's why I think it's great that we're picking which ones were our favorites and why. Mm.
How aware were you of the original British film before doing the series?
Oh, I remember it.
Okay,
very
so you
well.
Knew, yeah,
yeah.
Very different Crypt Keeper, obviously.
Oh yeah,
and,
that was
Richardson. Yes, yeah, Richardson. Yeah.
Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah.
Which wasn't so far off from the comic book, but it was.
Well, there's one episode they have in common, which we'll get to in our episode rundown. Yeah.
But the Crypt Keeper, Kevin's always said, he's always said that he took the different characters from the comic book, the Old Witch and the Crypt Keeper and the Vault Keeper, and tried to put elements of all three of them into this one character. It was one of the things that he tried to do, so I thought that was kind of cool. I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, you know... He had a version with the nose, and it just wasn't as good as the version without the nose. I'm sorry. But he did a great job. And people are like, well, how did you come up with the voice? I said, I totally came up with it off of what I saw when I walked into his studio.
Oh. You know? So you had to see the face first.
Yeah, totally. You know, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew how I wanted to deliver it. But as far as what the vocal quality was, I saw he had the holes in his throat and the rotting teeth and the texture. And I was like, and that's where I went with it.
The only other thing I wanted to bring up was sex.
I'm married.
Okay. Not now, Frank.
But thank you.
Yeah. Because I must have seen that. I must have seen the censored version growing up, because I grew up in New Zealand when I would watch these. And I know they sold it, you know, when they sold it to the other networks.
Fox.
Yeah, because I never sort of, we didn't have HBO. So watching it again for this, like I watched, I don't know, 20 episodes in the last couple weeks. My mind
you
was
got a
blown.
Bone, right?
Yeah.
Have I got a James. Bone for you?
Sure.
Please keep your hands above the table.
All right, there we go.
Oh, hey!
But yeah, I did. No, but I was really blown away by how sexual. I mean, it's an incredibly adult, incredibly sexual show, and I see why everyone was seeing it younger than the generation. These were adult stories, and something I kind of bemoan, besides independent film now. With independent film, you can make whatever you want. You make your story you want. But in horror, so much is being kind of neutered. I feel like there just isn't a lot of sexuality in horror. And to me, those two things have always made for the best
companions. Always a girl in her underwear being chased by a guy with an axe.
Right, but that's like on the nose. Like often these are about sex. These are about infidelity. These are about relationships and all the fears.
And they're all based on, all of them except for the very last episode of The Three Pigs, which was done by my good friend Bill Kopp. I'd done a lot of cartoons for him. They're all based on stories from the EC comics, from different versions of the EC Tales from the Crypt, Two-Fisted Tales, I mean, whatever, different ones that they were able to license from EC Comics and William Gaines at the time. So they tried, in fact, they even used some of the comic books as storyboards for some of the episodes,
oh,
like
cool.
The way you look at a frame. Those artists, if you look at any horror movie today, those images and in those comic books and stuff are used even in like The Walking Dead and stuff. You see it that look, that, you know, the hanging Spanish moss with the guy, you know, in the foreground you see just the shoulder of a guy holding a head and a body with no head walking away. You know, they would shoot it that way as if that was the storyboard for the actual show. So they were really good at honoring that, and the sex was in there.
Was it controversial though at the time? Because obviously that has set up what HBO would go on to.
Yeah, it was part of their. It was part of, you know, their formula: sports, comedy, and sex. Mm. You know, and you know, over the years, I did their first show, which was First and Ten, which was sports and sex, and then there was Dream On, which was comedy, sex,
On,
I did a character on that one. And then Tales from the Crypt, which was something a little new and different for them. And I remember they had the screening, and I'm sitting, you know, of it for the HBO people, and like a whole thing. And I'm sitting, and there's a couple of HBO executives sitting in front of me, and somebody behind me goes, "Wow, this is great television." And somebody went, "That's not television, it's HBO." And the two execs went,
"Oh, wow, there it is."
Like that. And it, like, it wasn't but a month later, it's like, "It's not television, it's HBO," you know? And so, you know, Tales from the Crypt, you know, set that tone. And, but, I mean, you know, they... People were like into it. I remember they had oh gosh, what's her name? She used to sing with Prince and stuff, and the other one, Vanity. She had an episode, and you know, normally you're doing nudity on the set, and they're like, you know, as soon as you've done the scene, they're gonna come in with a robe, and they're like, you know, and she's just like, "No, I'm good, I'm cool." Just walk around the set, but, you know. So it had that. I mean. It became part of the culture of the show in a lot of ways. And, you know, some people, you know, some directors didn't really want that to be the focus of their episodes. And other ones, like you said, you know, it was, they're all morality plays.
Yeah.
They're all, that's what they are. They all have, somebody gets at the end. Even in the cartoon, nobody died, but the kid would learn their lesson in the end. They're all morality plays, and historically, sex for favors, or, you know, then there's episodes like, you know, Meatloaf hanging on a hook and becoming chili. So, which is a funny story to that, because he had just lost a lot of weight when they were making that, and he was really upset that he had to wear a fat suit because they wanted him to be a fat guy. Right. And they kept catching him in his dressing room pulling stuffing out of the fat suit. He goes, I just lost all this weight and I got to go on camera in a fat suit? It's like, yeah, you're going to be hanging on a meat hook and people are going to be slicing pieces off of you. And you're going to wind up in the chili.
I believe that one's going to get mentioned.
Story in itself. Yeah.
It is. So we all picked, we decided to do a little homework and pick five of our favorites each. Elric, you went back and rewatched the show for this assignment, correct?
I watched a lot. Like, so I haven't seen it in about 15 years, besides, you know, infrequently. I've never sat down to, like, really dive in again since watching them. I don't, to be honest.
93 episodes, by the way.
From, what, 89 to 96, is that right?
Yes.
That's a hell of a stretch. The one season I don't remember is the British season, so I think I still need to jump in. I don't know if any of us picked one from
none of them would
none of us picked from the British. Even though Bob Hoskins isn't one, right?
I think so.
Bob Hoskins. I think a lot of us were probably just going with our gut and the things that we remembered.
Yeah, I didn't revisit this time. I think I did maybe several years ago. I started from first episode and went through all seven seasons, and it took me like 3 months. But I went from memory, because you always remember it's either the actor, the hook, whatever the twist was. You just need to mention that one little thing. You're like, oh, yeah, that episode. I love that one. So I instinctually went through all the synopsises, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the one. Yeah. That stuck with me. So.
Yeah.
I love that one. Vanity was naked in that one.
won't be that honest.
How did you gals pick your episodes?
Sorry, ladies.
I actually revisited the series a couple years ago, so some of it was from memory, but some of it was from recent memory. But there's the ones that I was 6 years old when this show started, so, you know, I remember watching
them. Oh, just rub that in her face.
Yeah.
But I literally watched them at my grandmother's house, because we didn't have HBO at my house, so I would watch them at friends' houses or with my grandmother, and so some of them, you know, stuck with me as a kid.
How is that, watching that with your grandma? That's interesting. Like, when things get raunchy, is anything said? Or is that just kind of like silently like, yeah?
I have the coolest grandmother ever.
Okay.
I hope my dad doesn't listen to this, because I am going to confess that my first porn I got from my grandmother.
Wow. Do you have the title on hand?
It was on VHS.
Okay.
It was a whole collection.
They all were. Back then, a different generation.
No, bootleg.
Oh, bootleg. Bootleg porn. Oh, God. That's dirty. How'd you get on the show?
It was horror bootleg porn. It was called Pop You're Scary. It was
That's a whole other podcast.
That's a whole other show. I like it. Right, so we'll go back to your copulation story. Should we get your mom for a second? Is she cool with that? Or no? She's shaking her head. No. I am genuinely curious. When did you first hear of it? Because you're into horror and you have a show about franchises. But when did you first hear about Tales from the Crypt?
So my parents both watched it when it was on, my dad in particular. So my first introduction to Tales from the Crypt was actually that my dad made up words to the theme song.
Well, she told me this just
there
before I got
actual,
up.
There
yes,
are actual
I said
lyrics.
That.
I know, and I'm going to guess that those ones are better than the ones my dad made.
We can look them up. I want to hear them.
Was this a horror song, or was he taking the theme into a different direction?
It was just very descriptive.
Okay. Oh.
So it was like, down the stairs and in the basement, there's a spooky puppet.
I love that.
And this is like when you're a baby, he's just like singing this.
I grew up as a kid hearing that song and not really having any context for it. So he was a big fan. And so when I was older, I think I was in college when I started watching them for the first time, but I was also very familiar with the Crypt Keeper just as like an icon, because he's around, he's everywhere. So I think I watched them for the first time more recently than any of you did.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I, you know, love horror, so that was something that I was automatically into. And I also, I love puns. I love especially horror anthologies I always liked. I grew up watching The Twilight Zone and that sort of thing. So it just sort of came naturally, and I rewatched it right when I heard about this.
Did you rewatch for things that you already were remembered, or were you trying to watch new things?
Okay. A little bit of both. So I went to the ones that I remembered, and then I was like, I should probably see some of the ones I haven't seen, because I don't think I've seen all of them yet, because there's so many.
Yeah. No, there's seven seasons.
They're addictive. They can't stop.
And I was watching them kind of piecemeal and not in any order, so I would forget like where I was in terms of anything and not be able to find the new ones. But
yeah, the biggest surprise was how long they are. Because I was talking about this last week, in my brain there were 45-minute things. So when we were going to prep for this, I was like, oh, God, that's going to be a long time. And I started watching them. It's like my favorite one, which we're going to get to in here, it's like 21 minutes. 20 minutes. It's like a short film. But it's like such a high – and somewhere like 30.
There was no – you know, because it was HBO, there was no amount of time you needed to put on there. So they'd make it – you could make it 21 minutes. You could make it 40 minutes if they liked it. You know, of course, once they sold it to Fox, then they had to – they not only had to cut out the nudity, but they had to cut out stuff just to fit in the commercials.
Yeah, right.
So if it was longer than the 22 minutes that you get in a half-hour show. And then there were certain – I mean, you know, they would show some of them together, and then some of them would have the Crypt Keeper sequences or the opening with your dad's lyrics. That's kind of like the Bruce Springsteen version of it. Down the stairs, around in the basement, a puppet jumps out of the coffin. you know, I mean, it was, you know, they'd have to sometimes edit those, you know, just to fit it all in, which is a shame because they were, each one had its own kind of thing. But a lot of people will tell me, you know, even if they didn't like the episode, at least the tales, you know, the Crypt Keeper sequence was always, you know, something that they would enjoy. Yeah, Crypt Keeper's kind of like the ride up to the, you know, roller coaster. You know, we all like, that's always scary, no matter what roller coaster you're on, because you don't know how good or scary it's going to be. But the anticipation of it is great. And then, you know, the even though the roller coaster ride is not as scary as you expected it to be, you know, you knew that that was going to be good. So, it had a lot of really great things by design, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just would encourage people listening. I know people in here are probably here for the reason because they're here for this. But for those who are listening, for me, this was the best way to kick off my kind of Halloween season again because it is spooky and fun. Some episodes are actually scary and disturbing, and a lot are just fun.
They hold up.
Yeah, they hold up. Unlike a lot of anthology, and especially on TV, where you see the constraints of the budget often.
Right.
I don't see those because I see the talent. I see the talent of the director.
Also, practical effects hold up. Where CGI, like you know, 3 months later, you can go, "Oh man, that sucks compared to the new movie." Yeah. You know, and it's like it was only 3 months ago.
Yeah.
You know, but that's one of the great things about it, and the comic books, and you still have to attribute it to the comic books that were from the 50s and the 60s and that they still hold up.
Yeah. Well, why don't we start with Ego? Because the first one you're going to talk about is also your starring vehicle. Not by design. This is John. I'm talking to you.
Is it?
From the list I have. We're doing fives.
Yeah.
And John's
five.
So what we're going to do, so I'll just let everyone know. So we're going to count down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, each one of our picks.
John picked his five favorites too.
Yeah, we all picked our. Okay. But yeah, he actually is in on this. Let's just let. And so for you guys, you're going to also get to see clips. I have no idea what people at home listening are going to be hearing or seeing. It's very strange. They'll be watching VHS porn. It doesn't matter. But you guys will look over there and we will, just anything you remember from each episode.
Yeah, that would be funny just to have the Crypt Keeper as the soundtrack watching
laughing at them.
Here's your brain after watching Tales from the Crypt.
See, Theo doesn't get that joke.
Before your time.
Mine was Oil. My number five was Oil's Well That Ends Well. And although it wasn't, what you know, content-wise, wasn't maybe one of my favorite episodes, if I put it into context, it starred yours Ghoulie on camera. I had an amazing time shooting that episode. Like I said, Paul Abascal directed it, I got to work with Lou Diamond Phillips. To this day, when I run into him, we still remember what fun we had working on it. And he's like, dude, you know, hey, you know, I ran into him at a restaurant, like, I don't know, what was it, 6 months ago? And he was like, hey, he was introducing me to his wife. This is the guy we did Down on the Grip with, you know. And we had Priscilla Presley on the show, which was just like unbelievable. It was like meeting Elvira. You know what I mean? It was just so cool meeting her. And she was so sweet, so wonderful to work with. And she was in lingerie the whole time. And, Alan Ruck, who you know from
Ferris Bueller,
and Rory Calhoun, who is one of those, you know, cowboy stars who is, you know, like John Carradine.
I actually think somebody had a T-shirt of Motel Helen here.
Really?
I thought when I saw somebody come in, and he's the farmer in that.
He was in it, which was just an honor to work with him. And it was just we had a great time shooting it.
Yeah.
It was amazing, and they put in some really wonderful little tributes. Like there's a point where I pop out of a coffin. Like, they've buried me. They've given me some drug to act like I'm dead, and we're pulling a scam. And I literally pop out of a coffin with, you know, and like, you know, laughing. And it was just, you know, an inside joke that this is the Crypt Keeper. But I literally had to be put in a coffin and have dirt put on top of it, have Lou Diamond Phillips dig it off me, and then I had to pop out. And I mean, let me tell you something. That was maybe like the most challenging thing that I've ever done in my career. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, the scariest part is when you're in the coffin and they're putting the dirt on it, and you're hearing. I don't know if I could do it today. Just thinking about it makes me claustrophobic.
But you got to do the best Crypt Keeper version for that episode.
Because that's why I love it.
Yeah, that's the best part.
The best part of the episode is the outro to the show. The Crypt Keeper's got his feet up and he's watching me on the screen and he like stops it and goes, you know, the other actors were good, but there's something about this one. He's a real Gory Cooper, a Robert Redford. And that voice, I could swear it reminded me of someone I know.
So, spoiler alert, we actually have that in our clip.
Okay.
Excellent.
Let's play it. How do we do this?
I'll come back from the dead, and I'll rip your head off, and I'll shit down your fucking throat. You got that, you flea-bitten hose bag? Do I make myself clear?
Call me old-fashioned, but I just don't think that's any way to talk to a lady who gives great head.
As like you said, the oil surveyor's a three-man con. Nice to see you again, Gina.
Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And today? Today has been a real bitch. Shit! You know, kiddies, there's something about this little tale that interests me.
Well, I'll be damned.
I think it's this actor. Yes. The others are good, but this one, we're talking a real bleeding man type. He's a regular Gory Cooper, a Robert Redford. And that voice, I could swear it reminds me of someone I know.
I wonder how many people that was over their head when they're watching the show. They had no idea you're the guy.
That's well, great. He does laugh in the Crypt Keeper voice in the episode.
Yeah.
Hopefully somebody's paying attention. A little bit of a tip.
Yeah. That's a great one. So my number five was one of the ones I remembered most without even having to think about it was Only Skin Deep, directed by William Malone, who did House on Haunted Hill, which, you know, he uses similar effects. Like, and this one nice thing about this episode, unlike a lot of the ones we're going to mention, is not horror comedy at all. This is scary, disturbing, sexually disturbing. Everything about it is pushing the envelope. It's a guy who's kind of an abusive ex-partner of a woman goes to, I think it's a Halloween party. Yeah, it's a Halloween party. To kind of get in her face, and everyone's telling him, "You got to get out of here." And he's losing his temper, and he goes into the the kitchen and sees this beautiful woman who has this interesting mask on, and he's wearing a mask. And she says, "You know, they basically kind of have a connection." And she says, "Well, why don't you, you know, come back with me? But the only rule is you have to leave your mask on. I don't want to see your face. I don't want to know you. We can hook up, but I don't want to know anything about you." And of course, he wants more after their night together. And then it goes to such a disturbing place. It's actually one of the most disturbing episodes, but the effects are great. The way William Malone does that little twitchy horror blur that he does so well, and that was before House on Haunted Hill, or right around the same time. It's, yeah, yeah, close. It stuck with me, and the way it, and where it kind of goes to, is really disturbing. So let's throw to the clip, because in the future we can throw to the clip first, maybe. I don't know what I'm doing.
Whatever
here.
You want.
Let's have a look.
Let's make a deal.
Mm-hmm.
We know each other's first names.
Mm-hmm.
We leave it at that. Huh? Nothing else. No last names. No bios. No pet peeves. Nothing. Not even faces. We leave our masks on. Anonymity in its purest form.
I'm a body bag. I thought the invitation said come as you are.
Well, how are you a body bag?
A synthetic shell with a corpse inside.
No mask.
What are you doing? We had a deal.
That was before.
Nothing's changed. It was never a mask, Carl. It's the way I was born.
Yeah, the one thing that... No, it's not. It's not Carrie Fisher. I don't know who that actress was. Do you know? Been a while.
I did know. Why am I having a brain fart? I'm sure we can look it up.
I mean, the one thing that jumps out in this series, which I really like, and especially in this episode, is the monsters win in this. Like we're looking at these morality plays, like marriage doesn't win. If you get married, the person's going to cheat on you or kill you, basically, in most of these episodes, especially the ones I picked. But you know, basically, the monsters tend to win. And there's often this moment like that where this person who's a monster is the one we can identify at the end, because we're all a little bit monstrous in some way, and that they stand in for us, which I really like about for a TV show. I felt like it was super original. So this one really works for me still. Holds up really well, too. I just watched it again.
Yeah, we had a Q&A at the Long Beach Horror Convention this summer, and Ernest was there, and he was there, and he brought that.
Oh, cool.
He brought the mask. Costume
oh,
and
yeah.
The mask.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Had it on stage.
Sherry Rose, okay, cool. Thank you. Yeah, she's really strong in it. It really holds this episode together, because he's such a dick, like the guy, the character in it. I mean, he's abusive from frame one, so there's no way you can like him, so you want him to get his comeuppance pretty quick.
Yeah.
So next up is Jess.
Yes, so my number five is All Through the House. This is the Christmas episode. It was originally in the movie. I'm actually surprised it wasn't on anyone else's list. It's now officially part of my holiday viewing, so in my house we watch horror movies all year round. We just keep them thematically appropriate for the time of year. And this is a mandatory Christmas viewing in my house.
You have to get the Christmas album to play with it.
Do you have a copy?
Oh, you do?
I said, let me have it.
Merry Christmas, you son of a bitch. It's done. I did it. It's all ours. The money, everything. We're free.
Naughty or nice?
little trivia.
That screaming was not originally in the episode, but that's Bob Zemeckis directed that episode. That's his wife, his real life wife, playing the actress, who, wonderful actress playing the part. He didn't think the ending had the impact he wanted, and he asked Stephen King what he thought it needed. He goes, it needs her screaming at the top of her lungs, and they went back and shot awesome. That part.
So that's my favorite part of the episode.
And Larry Drake, of course, was incredible. I got to work with him a couple of times over the years. We did a Star Trek episode together that was incredible. He was amazing, and I always tip my hat to him when I get to see him do that. A lot of people, I don't know why people love the mixture of Christmas and horror, but they do.
They do.
A lot of people will tell me that's their favorite episode.
It's probably because Christmas is a home invasion.
Yes.
A stranger coming down.
A subtle one. Yeah.
So in this episode, the screaming is my favorite part. Yeah. I mean, she just goes for it. And it doesn't stop. It's almost to the point where you're like, is this going to... Oh, you're just going to keep screaming. Okay. Yeah. But it's great. So she tries to... She murders her husband, presumably to get all of his money and run off with someone who we don't know anything about. And then this escaped mental patient, which there are a lot of escaped mental patients in this show. There are a lot of things that I've noticed revisiting these episodes that are a little cringy right now. But, you know, back then it was the 80s, it was okay. So she decides to frame him for murdering her husband, and then her daughter lets him in the open window upstairs. And I just love this one because it's so much fun.
And Larry Drake's character is a lot like that one family member that shows up at Christmas every year that we just can't take.
Let's see. My number five is season one, episode three, Dig That Cat, He's Real Gone.
Oh, yeah.
Which is directed by Richard Donner, starring Joe Pantoliano.
Joe Pants.
From Sopranos. And I just, look, the thing I love about the show, I love a good morality tale, and I love a good twist. And this is early on in the show. They give you both, which basically is this guy, this kind of, I don't know, he's listed as a bum on the synopsis, but he gets an experimental thing in the back of his neck that gives him the nine lives of a cat. And so he's kind of recounting all the things he did to kind of make money using this power, knowing that he had additional lives, while doing his final stunt. He's recounting it from his coffin. And then he realizes, spoiler, I guess you're going to be
spoiling. This is all a spoiler, giant spoiler.
He realizes, oh, that cat had to give up one of its lives. Oh, shit, I miscounted.
Yeah.
So there we have, and hopefully we have a clip of that.
Ulrich will be buried alive at precisely the stroke of midnight, but we're not going to let him out until noon tomorrow, at which time his precious, precious oxygen will have been exhausted. Folks, this is an escape that Houdini himself couldn't have gotten out of. I give to you, Ulrich the Undying!
I became a sensation. Crowds would gather from miles around just to see me bite the
big lies of this poor cat. Wait a minute.
I already died once. It only had eight lives left. Oh my God.
Well, I mean, production value, right? Like, most half-hour shows would not go through and create a carnival or whatever it is. So I think that's one of the things that sticks with you rewatching these, for sure.
They had fun doing it. Dick Donner and Bob Zemeckis and Walter Hill directed the first three episodes, and they had a blast doing it. And, you know, they did an amazing job.
Mm.
Those three episodes are, you know, incredible episodes.
All right, Theo.
Okay, so my number five, this is the one I had the hardest time choosing, but I went with The Secret, which is an episode about a little boy in an orphanage who he's like kind of unadoptable, and then he gets adopted by this kind of strange couple. I find it weirdly charming, and that's why I went with it. So I think, let's roll the clip.
We've got to do something about Theodore. He's well past the desirable age for placement. Most adoptive parents are looking for some cute little toddler.
What happened to his real parents?
You must never, ever mention his real parents.
Home at last. Oh, it won't be long before you'll forget all about that nasty old orphanage, Theodore.
Our secret.
So the plot of the episode is that he, you know, something mysterious happened with his parents. We don't know. He gets adopted by these people who turn out to be vampires who adopted him in order to drink his blood. Turns out he's a werewolf. And he didn't know this. He's turned into a wolf an unknown number of times, and he realizes right as they're about to get him, and he gets them, and just shows up back at the orphanage like, yeah, I know my deal. And he's just, like, he's one of those kids that's a troublemaker, but like, he's not a bad kid. He's just like a little werewolf. He feels like kids I know. I think that's why I love it so much.
I like the Twin Peaks connection. Laura Palmer's mom's in there. That's
yes,
cool.
Chris Zabriskie. I chose a few Twin Peaks actors, I realized.
All right, back to the top.
Awesome. Number four, that's you, John.
Okay, well, another vanity choice. Only it was the Crypt Keeper's vanity choice. Lower Birth, which is about the birth of the Crypt Keeper. And directed by Kevin Yeager. Which was, you know, Kevin and it was probably the person that I worked with the closest, and of course was a part of the alter ego of the Crypt Keeper as much as I was in terms of what he created. And so it was really, really an amazing episode. And his brother, Jeff Yeager, played the Crypt Keeper's daddy, and the mummy played his mummy. And I just thought it was a great episode. It was not only well directed, but it's a great story. And it's about the birth of the Crypt Keeper.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, look upon Enoch, the two-faced man.
It became imminently clear that something of equal worth would have to be bartered as collateral. Her name's Mirana.
Showtime now beginning.
The fourth one I did, one I hadn't actually seen before, and I caught up to it, Forever Ambergris. The reason I picked this one, A, you never get to see Steve Buscemi doing anything in practical effects, really. And this is such a gory episode. Also, you know, if you like the lead singer of The Who, Roger Daltrey is the star. His hair is really the star. It's you know, this again, it's quite a serious one, very sexual. Roger Daltrey has a thing for Steve Buscemi's beautiful wife, doesn't really understand why she's with him. They are both very famous, in the field photographers of war events. And Steve Buscemi's the up-and-coming photographer. And basically, at a key point, Daltrey tricks Buscemi into going to a village that some sort of toxin has been leaked, and he starts to fall apart. And it's really one of the most horrific things I've seen in a television episode. The practical effects as Steve Buscemi is falling apart and his entire body is coming back from him. And there is a great twist. I'm not going to ruin this one unless the clip does, but there's a great twist to the end of this one, how the wife gets revenge on Daltrey at the end. So this is a really fun one if you're looking for a horror. Hard. This is Gary Fletcher,
who's obviously, you know, pretty major director, made Things to Do in Denver, Bring You Dead, which is a fun movie. But yeah, let's have a look at the clip.
You like to watch, don't you, Dalton?
Excuse me?
Oh, you know, photographers. They watch while others do.
Ah! 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 What's the matter? Ah!
Burn! I burn!
What burns?
Oh,
what's wrong?
I don't know!
The hell break!
You take your pictures, and you don't come back. There goes that wonderful eye of yours.
Yeah, it's really messed up. Oh, the one thing I was really excited to learn, because I was like, who is the actress in this? Her name's Lisette Anthony. She is in my favorite fantasy film of all time, Crawl! And I didn't realize it until this moment, which isn't in 3D, unfortunately. Anyway, Lisette Anthony. So this is a great episode if you're looking for really hard horror. This is hard horror.
I was originally supposed to be in that episode, not The Oil's Well That Ends Well, but I had booked something else, and I wound up not doing it. I don't know.
Which character would you have been one of
those
guys?
You know, they did a head cast on me, so I don't know if it was, did somebody else die violently as well?
I think probably before Buscemi, to show you that the plague happened.
Yeah, so I don't remember, but okay. I knew that it was going to die violently. But
cool.
That's all I know. That's all I remember.
Jess, you're up.
So my number three is Top Billing. This is another From Memory pick. When we were looking through these at my house, my husband was like, I don't like that one. Well, I don't care about you. This one just stuck with me. I always thought it was funny. And I think part of the reason why I like it so much is I never really liked John Lovitz. Yeah. And this episode makes you feel bad for not liking John Lovitz.
Nice.
But yeah, so he's a failing actor, and he goes to audition for Hamlet, and then he meets the director of a small production of Hamlet, who is John Astin. John Astin is in this, and Paul Benedict, and a few other familiar faces. I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah.
You want to do it?
I'll get the part myself, and I'll be brilliant. You know what? I'm going to take my rave reviews, my $250 a week, and shove them down your fucking throat! Excuse me. I'm here to audition for the role of Hamlet.
Are you out of your fucking mind?
That you really have no idea until the end. There are zero tip-offs that these are all escaped mental patients, again, who are just on the loose, enjoying putting on a production of Hamlet. And he comes to find out, for those of you who haven't seen it, they're actually looking for someone to play Yorick. If you know the story, he's been dead for 23 years before the start of the play, so they're actually looking for a skull. So he keeps, this poor actor who keeps getting told he doesn't have the look, he doesn't have the face, he may be a good actor, but you just don't look the part. Well, everybody's got a skull.
Excellent choice. Let's see, my number four is season 4, episode 6, What's Cookin', which is directed by Gilbert Adler. It stars Christopher Reeve and Judd Nelson. And basically, Christopher Reeve and his wife have a restaurant that's not doing so well. And then this very creepy stranger comes in to work with them, Judd Nelson. And he starts making a very secret steak that everyone can't get enough of. And actually, you spelled it was meatloaf. Literally, meatloaf.
Why does meatloaf always get eaten?
Yeah.
Honey, if you bury that thing in the back of my neck, you're just going to wreck the blade. It's a real expensive cleaver. They don't make them anymore.
Then I'm going to be back tomorrow with an eviction notice and a new set of locks. One other tiny little thing. You're one lousy cook.
You fat son of a bitch!
You found his car in an alley near here. That and his empty wallet.
What happened?
Don't know. Looked like there was a hell of a struggle, though. Blood all over the place.
Blood? Is he dead?
Don't know. There was no body.
I don't know what the recipe is, but that's brilliant.
Mmm. That is absolutely damn good. Mmm. Yes. Yes. We are going to be rich.
No. 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 No.
All right. Dia, you're up.
So my number four is You Murderer, which, if you haven't seen it, kind of stars Humphrey Bogart. You'll see in the clip, I'm sure. So the reason I chose this one is because I actually am a big classic film fan, and my love of horror started with a love of classic film, where I was watching like the Universal Monster movies and Hammer Horror and Hitchcock and all of that. So I felt like this made perfect sense to add to my list.
Whether it was legal or not, I robbed, cheated, even killed. I did a lot of hard time before I got wise to what a sucker's game it was. And fortunately, no one was offering second chances. So I busted out of the joint, got a new name and a new face.
Haven't I seen this guy someplace before?
Nah.
And I just mentioned this on the last episode, so forgive me for being repetitive, but I'd done the commentary on Bordello Blood with Al Katz, and he was saying that this was kind of Zemeckis' trial run for Forrest Gump. He's like, can we put like an actor that's no longer with us in an episode? And apparently he liked to be very collaborative. He showed up to say, he's like, all right, guys, how the hell are we going to do this? I don't know. What are we going to do? How are we going to do it? And so they figured it out, and that's kind of how he got that down for Forrest Gump, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, he was using it a little bit for experimentation and a little bit of a playground. And of course, we did wind up doing a wraparound with, the Crypt Keeper as Forrest Gump.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
And he's sitting on a bench with Alfred Hitchcock next to him instead of the the Afro-American woman waiting for a bus. You know, it was great. It's a great sequence.
And for the classic film nerds in the audience, it's also must be a reference to Dark Passage.
Yes.
Because in that film, Bogart's the criminal who gets the face of Humphrey Bogart after surgery. So it's kind of a great double.
And that's a POV film as well.
Yeah. The first half is all from a perspective. Yeah.
Which anytime you can pull that off, I think is so impressive, because that is a hard thing to do.
Yeah. And that must have been one of the earliest examples of that, I'd have to guess. Arsenic and All Nice, okay. Cary Grant. Oh, before the original one. Okay, yeah. Wow, we got smart audience. I mean, not all of you, but yeah. Him.
So, my number three was The Man Who Was Deaf.
Mm. First episode of the whole show. Right?
Yeah.
This is it, yeah.
It was not the first episode shot, but the first episode aired. Shown, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Bill Adler. Sadler.
William Sadler, yeah.
My brain is the jet lag is creeping in. Who has been one of my favorite actors and become like a professional friend over the years. He's just so good in it. The episode is so good. It's so classic Tales from the Crypt. It so feels like the comic book. But yet, it feels like something you've never seen before, where he breaks the fourth wall. He's like Deadpool. He talks to the camera, talks about, you know, it's an ugly job, everybody's got to do it. Walter Hill directed this episode, and who we all love, and 48 Hours, Dreamscape, you know, all these great movies. And he was able to call in a favor and get Ry Cooter to do the music for it. And it just had such style to it. it was just so well done. It's one of my favorites to describe as an episode when I tell people about the show who didn't know the show back in the day. And then the Crypt Keeper sequence is just brilliant. He's frying himself in the electric chair and getting off on it, and just having a good time. So that's all the reasons why I loved this episode so much. It's not only it's my top three, but it also ties with my top two and top one as well. It's just so good.
First thing you got to understand is when it's their time, all these big tough guys go yellow, crying and hollering and screaming, blubbering. The governor's gonna call and all that. Well, I've been here 12 years, and the governor ain't called yet. Never looked the prisoners in the eye, afraid they're going to get spooked or something. Not me. I always look.
Only a few hours after the execution of Charles Ledbetter, opponents of the bill claim the death penalty has proven an effective deterrent against violent crime, and its abolition will only push the crime rate higher and produce more overcrowding in our prisons. Many also claim that execution is still murder in the eyes of God.
They put executions on TV be the fucking highest rated show of all time. Be Nielsen's through the roof. Other networks would start killing people just to compete. Pretty soon, Geraldo Rivera be pulling that switch. And he ought to pay.
Sentence you to death. That sentence to be carried out immediately.
Wait a minute. Yeah. No test idea. I didn't know he'd really go through with
that. Shut up,
Cynthia. You gotta believe me.
Shut up, Cynthia. Go. Wait.
I wonder how you're gonna dance when I put 10,000 volts through your ass.
He, of course, gets caught, and they reinstate the death penalty, and he's the first one to go. I just love that. I mean, that shot of her in the hot tub is just right out of a comic book. You know, I mean, they must have even told her how to put her hands and everything. It's so great. Literally a frame out of the comic book.
As I was watching their death, because the other guy's Garrett Graham, who's a beef. Yeah. From Phantom of the Paradise, when I was watching them die, it was like watching the two tones of the show in one scene, where you could keep the camera on him and you're going to have a horror comedy, or you could cut to her and show a really disturbing horror film, and they made the choice to stay on her because he's so goofy and over the top. But it's such a great scene. I went with this one, a smaller one called Undertaking Pallor. And this, you know what, I'm watching this episode again going, man, this reminds me of the Goonies. In terms of just vibe, it just starts with a bunch of kids who are walking out of a horror film, and then they're making fun of each other, and then suddenly this like POV from a camera starts following them, and this like hooded figure starts stalking them, and they're kind of about to pee their pants about it, and it turns out it's just one of their friends with his VHS camera, and they're all kind of joking around, and they're like, we should break into the morgue and film something. Of course, they break in the morgue, and what they then witness is that the Undertaker is in cahoots with, what is the other guy, pharmacist, and they're in cahoots, and they're knocking off all the richest people in this town and killing them. And the kids know this, and the kids have to, basically one of their parents also gets knocked off, and as a group they come together to get revenge. And this had such a great innocence to it compared to some of the episodes, and it wasn't about adult affairs. This was just about kids trying to course correct adult mistakes, and I loved it. But the cool thing is, just in researching it, because the vibe was the Goonies, it turns out the guy who made this one, his name's Michael Thau. He was a more of a producer-editor, but he was the editor of Small Soldiers by Joe Dante, but he worked on The Goonies. And he was like a guy that Richard Donner, I guess, handpicked from being a PA to kind of give him more and more responsibility. But if you haven't seen this one, because this is just one I haven't heard as much discussed, I think you'd really have a good time with it. It's just a very fun vibe.
Well, and Data's in it, too. Data from The Goonies.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So, yeah, you're right. He's the one with the video camera, yeah. And an actor from Hocus Pocus. As well, yes.
That's true.
Yes, very much so. Let's have a look.
My father's been murdered by the town's undertaker, Sebastian Esbrook. And the pharmacist at Grundy's Pharmacy.
Piece of shit who wears snakeskin shoes.
Our mission is to try to get all the evidence on tape that
so
we can.
So we can fry this son of a bitch.
Why? That's the...
How would you like to shake hands with a dead man?
Come on, old girl. Give us a smile. Come now. You can do better than that.
Yeah, that was Joan Glover, as you're saying, so good, yeah.
And for the record, she does smile at the end.
Yeah.
And Aaron Eisenberg was in that. It was one of the kids who just recently passed away, sadly. Just wanted to mention that because he was a dear kid. I mean, a dear guy. He was just a great actor, a wonderful guy. Yeah. Just thought I'd take a little moment for that.
Yeah, nice.
Thanks.
You're up.
So you mentioned that the actor, one of the actors from Hocus Pocus, was actually in that episode.
Is it Jason Marsden?
It was Jason Marsden.
Mm.
We have
one of my favorite episodes that I ever saw.
Ladies and gentlemen, James Marsden,
the star of the episode. Oh yeah, sorry. I did write Jason Marsden, but. That was unplanned.
I just mumble sometimes. For a voice actor, I got terrible diction.
Well, I'm glad we picked that one. That would have been super awkward. You at the back heckling
I
us?
I meant that as a joke in case you had those glasses. So you could come out here in front. Surprise. No, I'm kidding. It's good to see you, man.
Yeah, that's cool.
He's acting strange. He doesn't suspect anything, does he?
Oh, God, I hope not. All I see is an old friend who loves us and wants to see us happy.
Of course you'd see that.
Richard, please. This trip is his anniversary present to us, and I don't want you to ruin it for him.
You're out of your fucking mind. And your dead friend. Anniversary, baby.
That is the best joke line. No, not really.
At that point,
well, it's called Three's a Crowd. Correct?
It's called Three's a Crowd. That one just always stuck with me because, especially when you, as a young person, you see that and you're like, "Holy shit!" There's nothing about that episode that's funny. It is utterly horrific. He's jealous of his wife's rich friend. He throws them a secret anniversary party. They've been trying for a kid, and well, surprised.
Yeah. What's amazing about things like that is that you don't really see it coming. You get so lost in some the web of their relationships that it actually pulled the joke works.
It's so convincing. Yeah. I mean, you're right there with them. You're like, oh my God, she's cheating on him. How dare she?
Yeah. That's awesome.
Okay, my number three is from season 2, episode 16. It's called Television Terror. And this is a great episode with Morton Downey Jr. And a lot of people have tried to do this sort of thing before where it's like, hey, let's do a live telecast from inside a haunted house or whatever it is. We've seen it, but this is kind of, in my opinion, the first to really pull it off. And it's actually genuinely scary and kind of creepy. So it's got that POV angle, the found footage angle, all of it. So, and also, Morton Downey Jr. was just like such a personality on TV.
Yeah, it's very Geraldo or something, right?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah. So, Television Terror.
Mass murder, dismemberment, suicide. It all happened right here on this quiet street in the heart of Los Angeles. Follow me. If you dare.
Hey, you
fucking dickhead.
Matt Horton, the network called. They want you to pick up the pace.
What?
Hey, the show's dragging. They're afraid it's going to be another Al Capone's vault.
What the?
Window, if you don't do something to spice it up.
What am I supposed to spice it up with?
You hear that?
Oh, Jesus!
Spicy enough for you?
That's a great one. All right, Theo.
So my number three is also a haunted house one, but I chose House of Horror, which, so it's about a frat that is hazing the new pledges. I didn't go to a school with frats, if that's going to be very clear very soon. So frat culture is already so bizarre to me, so I thought that was such an interesting take. And what I love about this one is that it is full of twists and turns. You think you know what's going on, and then you don't, and then you think you figured it out again, and then you don't, and then something like out of the blue happens. And also the ghost is called the Coffer, which is my favorite, because he like coughs, and that's his spooky thing. Which I just
an ailment more than anything.
Get back to work before I paddle your asses. Master, it's my job to make men of these boys.
Now, I always thought making men out of boys was a woman's job.
The house was condemned. That was 1933. Ever since then, people say the Coffer's ghost is still in there, making sure nobody's in his house.
DOA is an all-ghoul sorority. You're about to become Delta Omega material now. Dinner.
That's so good. Yeah.
It's a lot like Bordello of Blood, huh?
Okay, we're up to number two, and I picked, which one is this? Oh, season two, episode one, Dead Right. And I always remember this because it stars Demi Moore and Jeffrey Tambor.
Jeffrey Tambor is so good in this thing.
So creepy.
He's such a vile, terrible character.
Yeah.
And basically,
Demi... And has the same makeup from Transparent.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, pretty much.
Less subtle.
Kidding. Yeah, less subtle.
Less subtle.
I'm getting a lot of head shaking on that one. I'm sorry.
He already got in trouble himself for that, so you didn't have to do anything.
Demi, me too.
Demi Moore is a woman that wants to be rich and successful. She sees a psychic that says, this man that you're about to meet, as vile as he is, will inherit a ton of money. And so she's like...
And then die immediately after, terribly.
And so basically she's like... she meets him and she's repulsed by him, but she's like, I'm going to court him because apparently he's going to earn a lot of money and die. And then the twist, maybe we'll see in the
clip. Yeah, maybe.
No, maybe I'll spoil it for you. We'll see.
A great deal of money. It will come to him from someone near and dear to him. After he inherits the money, he will die. Violently.
I mean, I'm going to be a widow. A rich widow.
Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak.
How are you climbing?
Great, hey.
I'm next.
Great, hey.
Oh!
job.
Tell you nobody can. If I can't have you, nobody can. If I can't have you,
okay, context. So what happens is she wins the lottery, and he decides, oh, no, if I can't have you, nobody can. He kills her, so he inherits a shit ton of money and then goes to the chair.
Yeah, death row straight away.
He did indeed win a lot of money and die right away.
It's actually one of the – I only watched that one last night because it was on your list, and it has one of the most creative decisions I've seen in the show, which was – probably they're probably thinking, if we show a sex scene with him and Demi Moore, it's going to be so grotesque, people just don't want to see that. And that's why they have that Ginger Rogers Fred Astaire dance number. So just as they come together to make love, it cuts to that. And it's like one of the greatest choices I've ever seen, because this is a show built on sex, and instead they give you this like great show tune. And so I thought that was a super fun choice, you know?
Even the crypt keeper wouldn't have been able to talk his way out of that.
It was pretty gross. So we're a little out of order. You'll see why in a second. So Theo, hit your one.
So my number two is Let the Punishment Fit the Crime, which stars Catherine O'Hara, who's just one of my favorite actors of all time.
I agree.
But the thing about this episode is that I think this one feels the most like a genuine nightmare to me. Even though it's not the one that I find the scariest, I think it's the way that it's shot. I feel like I could have like woken up right after watching this and been in her position. So let's go ahead and roll the clip.
I gotta go. Wait a minute, wait a minute, wait. Jerry Ferret, attorney, specializing in personal damage claims. What's it gonna cost me?
$10.
All this bullshit for $10? Here, keep the change.
Not $10, Miss Ferret, 10 lashes. They can flail you now and you can be on your way.
Well, the fine is 100 lashes to be administered immediately.
This ain't scary. Scary is not being able to get a pacemaker because you sued the company into bankruptcy and then having to spend my life savings on surgeries instead.
Or dying because you can't afford a doctor because the doctor has to charge so much to pay for his malpractice insurance.
So some context for that one is that she's a like personal injury lawyer, sort of an ambulance chaser, and she ends up getting pulled over in this small town and has to defend herself in court. She keeps making things worse and worse for herself, so this public defender is helping her, trying to get her public service instead of 100 lashes. And it turns out that public service is becoming the public defender in this town until someone else comes along to take your place.
A Luke nightmare. This one's directed by Russell Mulcahy, who did Highlander, which is a great movie, and some other, Razorback, the Australian. So some good horror films in there. So, yeah, good choice. Okay, the next one, I'll let John kick it off, but this is one that three of us all selected, and that's why you know this is a great episode. This might be one of the absolute best episodes, Ventriloquist Dummy.
Stars my good friend Morty.
it's just great casting. I mean, you know, all right, you know, nobody knew how good of an actor Don Rickles was.
Yeah.
Obviously, Martin Scorsese did.
Yeah.
And but if you go back and look at some of those old, Rat Pack movies and stuff, he was always good playing himself.
You see, what is the John Landis? Is it Innocent Blood?
Yeah.
He's really good in that movie. Yeah. He steals the whole movie when he turns into a vampire, yeah.
Just incredible. Bobcat Goldthwait, not the best actor, but so perfectly cast in this character as the buffoony guy who's just not a good ventriloquist. And, of course, if you know the story, it turns out that something, you know, horrible happens in Don Rickles' character's career, where a woman dies in a horrible fire, and his career disappears, and he's hunted down by Bobcat Goldthwait years later. Happened to me on a date once.
Mic drop.
Thank you for getting that. not nailed down. Sorry. I choked myself on that one.
Oh, there's a fire. You're giving the plot of the... In his past, there was a bad fire. A woman burned to death.
Yeah, so Bobcat Goldthwait goes and searches for him later because he wants to know his secret, and he wants to be a ventriloquist, and he finds out his secret is, let's see if it shows. Yeah, it's
probably one of the craziest twists I've seen in a show.
Mr. Engel, sir, you probably don't remember me, but my name is Billy Coleman.
Piss off! You want it in writing, huh? Piss off!
I have been driving for 3 days. I am not leaving until you talk to me.
Hi, my name is Tim. Can Morty come out and play?
Oh, shit. Morty's like me. He's real. He's flesh and blood. In fact, Morty is my brother. My brother. He's dead.
Morty.
We were born like this. I guess we were meant to be twins, but nature can work in a cruel way sometimes. Rather than go through life as freaks, we decided on a career in show business.
Yeah, we decided to put our heads together. That's a joke, son. I don't see you laughing.
He's bleeding at the end.
All right, you little fucker. I'm gonna park you in the cheap fucking seat. Where are you? Come on out.
Who did the voice of the puppet? You know, I mean, do you remember?
I can't remember.
But it wasn't him.
No, Richard Donner directed that episode, and he loved that episode so much. In his office, he had one of those plexiglass, you know, cases that you would normally put like a football in or something. He had Morty in it.
That's so cool.
And he had it in his office, so every day when he walked in, Morty was right there. And it's just amazing. If you don't know what happens after that, they decide to work together. Yeah. And so Bobcat Goldthwait sews Morty to his hand and becomes a, you know, big act. But it's just unbelievable. Was that?
Yeah,
it's a happy ending. It's totally a hand job happy ending. But it's just so brilliant, and they were so good in it. We're splitting up the act. It's just so good. You can see why the three of us picked it as in our top three. You know, two. It's just so amazing. It's so classic Tales from the Crypt. I mean, there's so many horror movies and episodes, you know, Cliff Robertson in the Twilight Zone episode. And there's so many great ones made. I think there's an Outer Limits one with the ventriloquist dummy where the ventriloquist dummy winds up being the guy and the little person.
I didn't watch this one because I'm genuinely terrified of ventriloquist dummies. It's like the one thing that really gets to me.
It's a chronic fear, I think. So I have a few. I mean, it was one of the first things performance things I did as a kid. Back in the day where you could like drop your kids off and go shopping and people wouldn't arrest you for it. My mom used to drop us off at what they called the toy barn. Think Home Depot, but with toys. And she would go grocery shopping. She had five kids. And I would climb up on the shelf with a ventriloquist dummy. They had a Jerry Mahoney. And I would put him on the edge of the shelf and talk to people as they came by. So when I was in second grade, my mom bought me one for my birthday. I woke up, he was sitting on the end of my bed. And I still have him. He's probably in pieces now, but I still have him. And over the years, I was asked to do, you know, and I don't consider myself a real ventriloquist. I can bring the puppet to life, but I had never learned to properly throw my voice and that kind of thing. But I've played ventriloquists, you know, in a Mike Hammer episode where the dummy gets shot and sawdust comes out of his chest. And in Three Guys Naked, I did ventriloquism in that character in that musical and stuff like that. And I've just always loved it. I have a bunch of them. They're in the attic now because my wife didn't like me keeping them under the bed. I used to keep them under the bed. But they're pretty creepy, but I love them. You know, that's why the Crypt Keeper is so cool. You're bringing something inanimate to life. and they actually, you know, take it to the extra twist where he actually is alive.
Yeah, and I didn't see it coming at all. Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but that for me, that was not what I thought the thing was going to go. I thought it was a psychological episode, and when it went there to like full basket case, I was totally into it. But this is also your pick as well, just same thing.
It does such a great job of pairing horror with the macabre, where it doesn't take you out of it at all to deliver like the one-liners. Like, I'm splitting up the act. I mean, you're still in the moment of just like the blood and the viscera, but you still have the humor. And yeah, I mean, back when I first saw it, I didn't see it coming. It shocked me, and I loved it.
Yeah, that's a great episode. So that is everyone's number two. So now we're up to everyone's number one. So we'll start with Theo because there's another tie coming up.
So my number one episode is The Reluctant Vampire, which is, it's what it sounds like. And I think the instant this became my first episode is the opening shot where the main character wakes up and gets out of his Murphy bed coffin, which I just thought was the coolest thing ever. And he goes to work where he is a night security guard at a blood bank. And I love the sort of modern take on the vampire that's just like very practical. Realistic, convenient. It's not what you see most of the time. He's not really lurking around or wearing anything fancy, vampire-y. It's just what would happen in real life.
And it's Malcolm McDowell.
It is, yes.
Hello. Have you ever had any blood-borne diseases? Are you currently taking any drugs or any other medication? Have you had dental surgery in the last 72 hours? Have you?
No!
Music to my ears!
I don't want excuses. I want answers. Our blood supply is at a record low. We are tottering on the brink of bankruptcy, and all you can say is there are irregularities in the bookkeeping.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. Over the lips, over the pangs, say goodbye to hunger pangs!
And pure, just like nature intended.
Isn't there a shot in Clockwork Orange too where he's the vampire just for an insert? Yeah. My number one was one that just it's the one I remember most when I think about the show. It's the least horror, and it's a total mano a mano show. I also have a really soft spot for movies about gambling. I love gambling movies. Also, I love Walter Hill movies. One of my favorite directors. Cutting Cards is so badass. When you want to like look at tight economical filmmaking that just keeps ratcheting up the joke, it is Lance Henriksen as a kind of Reno gambler with a Texan hat, and he rolls into town to take on this, his kind of arch nemesis, who's much more of a businessman looking guy, played by Kevin Tiege, who's somebody you might...
So good.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy you won't know his name, and then you'll see him, you've seen him in every movie, but he was in Another 48 Hours, he's really good in that. This movie, this is so fun, and this is the one I was talking about. This one's like 21 minutes, and it is so tight. Like it's like peak Walter Hill, and it's, you know, an episode of Tales from the Crypt. I mean, how cool is that?
It was also the most imitated thing that we did over and over again in a wraparound with the Crypt Keeper.
Yeah, and it ties perfectly to the Crypt Keeper in this one. Sometimes they don't as well. This is perfect, fluid. If you haven't seen this one, it's an utter blast. And also, Lance Henriksen's just one of our greats. You know, he's such a good actor. Have a look. This is fun.
I want you out of my life for good. I really don't like you, Reno. Thinking's the fun part of it. You still feeling okay, Reno?
Don't mess with me, Sam. What do you got?
Two pair.
Three ladies. I feel great.
I'm sorry I took so long to answer the question. Which finger? Crying out loud, will you get off the pot and do something?
It's so good.
And then he says, pass the gum.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Grotesque. So our last one, we have a tie between John, Robin, Jessica, and I've got to admit, watching it again last night, it is probably one of the best episodes, one of the best performances. Take it away.
And I think before we talk about it, let's just do the title and watch it, and you'll understand why.
Should we watch the clip first? Yeah.
Yeah, let's watch the clip.
Pa! Where is that old goat? Pa! Where in tarnation are you? Wasn't no color TV till I fixed it. Now it's a color TV. Ugly bitch.
That was Death of Some Salesman, starring Ed Begley Jr., Tim Curry.
So good.
I mean, he's a legend. And, I mean, I've always grown up loving and admiring everything from Legend to Pennywise the Clown to, I mean, he's just done it all. And it's incredible.
Gil Adler directed that episode, and he had the guy with the vacuum cleaner coming out of his mouth in his office. That's what he had. And that episode, Tim Curry was nominated for an Emmy for that performance, and he was incredible. That's one of the reasons why it's my favorite. He's just so incredible. My parents, who really have never had any real understanding of the business, they're very old world people, and they're still alive, God bless them. My dad's 95, my mom's 90 years old. God bless them. They came out to visit me, and they had never really seen anything shot or had any concept of it. And I took them down to the set when Tim Curry was playing Winona, which is the daughter. He was just so amazing. I mean, it was amazing with my parents. He didn't break character, even though he wasn't wearing the wig at the moment, which made it really ugly. But they had gone to such lengths. Character was wearing earth shoes, and they had made these fake hammer toes so that, like, with long finger toenails on them. Not that you would ever have seen them, but that's how detailed they were about everything. And I know Tim had something to do with that. Like, can you give him some hammer toes or whatever? Because over the years, Tim and I worked on some cartoons together. Evil the Cat was one of them, and that kind of thing. And he's amazing. But that, to me, is the epitome of a great tale. And I think that's why Gil Adler, who was the showrunner at the time on Tales from the Crypt, nabbed that script, because he knew that that was going to be something incredible. I couldn't even tell you how they came up with the idea of having the same actor play all three characters, but I don't know that a lot of people could have done it as good as Tim Curry did. It was just amazing, and so that's why it's my number one.
I guess if we were counting down the best sex scenes in the show, if you guys like dirty underwear.
I can't.
The love scene is one of the craziest things I've ever seen.
I can't believe that clip's not on it. He lowers himself down to him and he goes, they just cut to Tim Curry's face and he goes, like this, and you're just like,
yeah, it's pretty gross. It's pretty great though.
If you don't know the story, he's trying to, the salesman is trying to pull one over on them and thinks they have some kind of money buried in the basement, or treasure, as they put it. And, of course, their treasure is all the salesmen they've killed over the years. So, there you go.
Yeah. Well, that was wonderful. Thank you for counting down the top five tales. Yeah.
And this is the 25th anniversary. Is that where you're counting down today?
30th
anniversary.
Oh my God!
You were young when you started this.
I was. People thought that they were expecting like Wolfman. I was expecting like a Wolfman Jack looking guy to show up or whatever, and it was me. You know, yeah, they're just like, wild. Holy crap. They, at first, they didn't want people to see me because they were like, oh no, it'll break the illusion of it. But then they were like, got me on talk shows and stuff. Howard Stern, we had come out with a Crypt Jam, and Howard, they had me call into Howard Stern, and Howard's like, oh, I hate Tales, I hate the Crypt Keeper. You know, I had him laughing so hard, though, that he was like, you know, it's not the Crypt Keeper I don't like. You're hysterical. It's the puppet, the puppet I don't like. It makes you, it's creepy. You know, it's an amazing journey we took with that show, and people were in it to make something great. Mm. And, you know, I hope we get to do it again one day. Will it happen? I don't know. You know, it involves getting rights back from EC Comics and money and lawyers and people who get along with each other and all this stuff, you know, and that doesn't always happen. And it's, you know, an expensive show to produce, so I don't know if they could do it today or not, but... we have 93 episodes, so that means we only have, what, 88 more to go?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go. Roll the clip.
I was watching them all on Amazon Prime, so if you're looking for where they are, they're all there. Watch their talk about it. It's a perfect way to get back into Halloween this season. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, thanks.
And if you don't own the box set, I don't get a cent on it, so I'm not, like, hawking it to you for that reason. It's amazing, and it's really affordable. I mean, it comes out to, like, less than a dollar an episode or whatever. But it has the behind-the-screens videos that come with the first episode and stuff are really great. In fact, some of the other episodes, there's features where you can turn on commentary where me and Alan Katz, who was one of the writers, and some other people are commenting on what we're watching and what was going on behind it. But the first season with the Behind the Screams is really amazing. What else do we have going on? We have photo ops for people who purchase. So,
yeah, afterwards you guys will have photo ops. If anyone wants to come and ask us anything, we'd love to talk to you guys. I know sometimes people don't come up to us because it's weird to come up to podcasters or something. People always go, it's weird, I hear you in my ear. I'm like, yeah, I talk. But please do, because it really helps us to know like what's going on with the crowd. Big thank you to Jessica and to Theo for joining us.
Yeah, that's thank you.
Last minute they came in, really last minute. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. This has been fantastic.
And a big thank you to Kevin, who obviously has put on the Salem Horror Film Festival and did everything to get us here in the first place. It was his idea to do this episode. Super cool.
Did you put together the clips?
No, your partner.
What?
Your partner put together clips.
Thank you for that.
That was amazing.
Thanks, yeah. Mike.
That was amazing.
And to John, who's like the embodiment of the show.
Thank you, John.
Embodiment of the show. Yes.
We need a pun to go out.
Oh boy. Be careful what you ask for.
Thanks so much for coming.
You may
guys.
Get it.
That's
great. It can't rain all the time, and Fright Rags is celebrating the 25th anniversary of The Crow with three brand new shirts. Also celebrate your love for Fangoria with the reprinted 1979 Stress Tee, along with brand new tees featuring the classic Starlog and my favorite, the Gore Zone logo. All officially licensed and available exclusively at FrightRags.com. Listeners get 10% off for their first order with code WAVES10. Beware, these scary stories will transform you. The Creeping Hour is a horror anthology series hosted by The Creeps. Three friends who listen to so many scary stories that they turned into monsters themselves. Gather your whole family to shiver with fright as you listen to the terrifying tales of The Creeping Hour. Listen if you dare. Don't say we didn't warn you. The Creeping Hour is a co-production of WGBH and Ellie Lichtenstein. It is appropriate for all ages and recommended for ages 8 to 12. It's at thecreepinghour.org.